I don't think I've ever preached with a plane behind me, so this could be quite fun. I'll try to keep it intact. But we're continuing our sermon series, the sermon series we're doing all throughout the summer as we look at the Sermon on the Mount. And so you've heard me say it before, but many different commentators look at the Sermon on the Mount as essentially the ethics of the kingdom of God. This isn't the only thing you were supposed to do, but as Christ works in you, if you've given your lives to Christ, then these are some of the ways in which your hearts and minds and lives begin to change, to begin to reflect the love of Christ more in your life. And so we've been looking at things like the Beatitudes as Jesus takes the people where they are and says, you are blessed, even when you face persecution. He tells them they are salt and they are light. They are to make a difference to the people who are around them. He tells them, I came to fulfill the law, that these things are important, but it's not what makes you righteous. You have to be perfect if you think that's going to make you righteous, and none of us are going to get there. This is God at work in you as Christ fulfills those commands. And then we started talking last week about anger, and what does that mean in our lives? And today we move on to the next section out of the Sermon on the Mount. And I want to say something that might be radical. Okay, it's not at all radical or revolutionary, but I think it is something that we need to hear in the church, and that's this. God cares about sex. God created the possibility of sexual intercourse from the very beginning, and He made it something beautiful and wonderful. Listen to how the story begins in Genesis chapter 1. As God has gone about creation, He then says this, so God created man in His own image. In the image of God, He created them. Male and female, He created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. God created humanity, man and woman, in His own image. And scholars debate over what that image of God really means. And we're not going to really go into that today, but I really want to just say that I think that's the ability to love, to connect, to be in relationship with one another. And I love the way that Genesis 2 poetically stages this moment. Genesis 1 is kind of the nuts and bolts of creation. Genesis 2 talks about what happens when Adam sees Eve for the very first time, and his response is a love poem. This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, and she shall be called woman because she was taken from man. Adam, out of his amazement and fascination at this person that God has created, expressed his love and connection through poetry. And as we go throughout the pages of the Bible, we find that God celebrates sex throughout the Bible. Indeed, an entire book of the Bible is dedicated to it. Most of you guys know I spent 3 years teaching in a private school in Memphis. I taught junior high kids, seventh graders, the Old Testament. And our task was to get through the entire Old Testament in a year. And that week came in which we were going to be getting to the Song of Songs, or the Song of Solomon. And I determined we were going to cover it all in one day, as quickly as possible, because here's a group of 12-year-olds. And I was going to do it in a way that talked about love and purity. Now, I figured that most of my kids were not doing the assignments and reading along, but I did have some dedicated students who were reading everything that we were doing. I don't know how you do that at 12, but God bless them. And they read it, and they came in that morning with a lot of questions. What does this mean? What are they talking about? Is this really about... And what does exactly that stand for? And so they just had more and more questions. And some of them grew more and more curious, and some of them grew more and more red in the face, the joy of being 12. But it might have been the class that received the most attention in that entire year. And people have always kind of struggled how we understand the Song of Solomon or the Song of Songs for thousands of years. Jewish rabbis started interpreting this as an allegory about the love God has for His people Israel. And Cyril of Alexandria was so perplexed by the book that he finally just said, I'm going to do what the rabbis did. This is a book about the love that Christ has for the church. It's an extended allegory. But that's not what Song of Solomon is about. Instead, it's about the celebration of a love that a couple has for one another and the way that that works itself out in their lives and in their sexuality. And it's right there in the pages of Scripture, because God cares about sex. And yet throughout the Bible, what we also find is that we have stories of sex and sin that begin to intersect. The entire plot is full of these problems. Abraham, at his wife's request, sleeps with her handmaiden Hagar, creating a whole host of problems moving forward for his family. Lot's daughters seduce him because they don't have any other choice for a man, they think. You have the story of Judah and Tamar and how that all plays out in the family. You have Potiphar's wife who tries to seduce Joseph, and when he runs away, tells lies about what he did. You've got Samson, who loved women, and they were constantly getting him into trouble. You've got Solomon, who loved women so much that he had about 900 of them hanging out around his palaces. And you have a whole host of other people. The text becomes littered with these sinful actions that begin with their sexuality. Augustine of Hippo was a man who converted to Christianity in his midlife. He had grown up in a Christian home, his parents were Christians, but he had rejected his faith as he got older. And indeed, he rejected his faith primarily because he wanted to live life the way he wanted to live it. And as he was kind of coming back around to faith and thinking about it, he writes in his small book, The Confessions, that this was one of the prayers he prayed: Lord, give me chastity and continence, but not yet. He started an affair with a woman that lasted for 15 years and produced a child. But when he came back to faith, Augustine was troubled by his old life, specifically his sexual promiscuity, and he constantly struggled with lust and temptation. He carried a lot of baggage he wasn't able to shake, and it colored his theology. For example, he began to reinterpret Genesis 3 and the fall, as we talk about it, the story of Adam and Eve, as a sexual experience. And he read it all allegorically, as that's how they fell. And he began to just see sex and sin as the exact same thing because of the baggage he carried with him. And his writings have influenced the Catholic Church and really all sorts of other Christian backgrounds throughout the centuries since. And that persists for many of us. Many of us here in the room are uncomfortable talking about sex with anyone, and especially in church. We kind of tense up when we hear the word. I worked as a youth intern for a church one summer. And as we were called in, we were given lots of flexibility and things we could do and things we could try, but there was one rule we couldn't even touch. That one rule was we weren't allowed to talk about sex or lust with the teenagers. Not even if they came up and asked about it one-on-one with a question. The parents were concerned that talking about sex in church would put it in their kids' minds and they might go out and try it if we talked about it in church. So they swept it under the rug and pretended it didn't happen. For many of us, sex was something that was taboo, both in church and in our families. Many of us just received a book from our parents that was going to talk about these conversations when it came to things like puberty and sex. If you want to know about it, here, read about it. I don't want to talk about it. But through our silence, sex is often perceived as something secret or slightly dirty or even shameful. And yet we also exist with this weird paradox, because sex is so pervasive in our culture. Most of us know that old advertising adage, sex sells, but it seems to be truly in vogue right now. You can't walk down the aisle, the magazine aisles in a bookstore or at the supermarket and not notice that sex sells. It's on every magazine cover out there, men's and women's, sports all the way down to cooking. They're taking this seriously, that sex sells. There's a makeover show on TLC that chooses women to be evaluated by others based solely on their look and style. Now, most of these women are considered kind of scary or put-offish in the way that they're talked about, but simply based on what you see, they show a picture to people on the street. Would you love, lust, or run from this person? Now, thankfully, what they're trying to do is to help these people understand that they don't have to put on a persona to be loved, but it's solely based on physical traits alone. You can't turn on the television without being inundated by sex. Some of the most popular television shows on TV right now, from Game of Thrones to Scandal to Grey's Anatomy, revel in the amounts of sexuality and nudity they can show on TV. In fact, my favorite show on TV is The Big Bang Theory. But that show also plays on the double entendre of its name in every single episode. And it affects our kids. According to the most recent study by Barna Group, young adults and teens see pornography as less immoral than littering. 2/3 of teens have engaged in sexting, receiving sexually explicit images in the form of a text. Pornography use is an epidemic. Almost 6 in 10 young adults, 57%, seek out porn either daily, weekly, or monthly. In fact, I think that statistic is kind of skewed, because when I was doing campus ministry, the statistic we were working with was that 50% of males in college were using porn every single day. But it's not just a problem for guys. Statistics say that 1/3 of pornography users are women. In fact, sex and nudity are so pervasive in our culture that the magazine Playboy, that kind of made it all vogue in the first place, made waves a few months ago when they decided to end nudity in their pages. According to their editors, it had become so easy to find that it just was blasé anymore. And those ideas and those stats and those statements color our understanding of reality, doesn't it? About what is and isn't acceptable, what is and isn't normal. We cannot say that it doesn't affect our hearts or have any effect on our society. Just one more. In March of this year, Time magazine did a study on the explicit television shows and pornography. And they found that 90% of the shows that they examined portrayed physical aggression towards women and its content. That abuse had become the new normal. So what does that do to our hearts? What does that do to our souls? What does that do to our understanding of relationships between men and women? What does that do to an understanding of healthy sexuality, of healthy love? Well, here's a story I think fits with that. In January of 2015, Brock Allen Turner sexually assaulted a young woman, Emily Doe, on the campus of Stanford University. And in a statement she read in court, she talked about how the last year and a half her life had been put on hold. She was now afraid of the dark, she couldn't sleep, and she was afraid of physical contact even from her own family. And she also shared how she was learning to overcome and to move forward in life in spite of the trauma she had faced, and she spoke with hope and resilience and even at times joy. But in defense of his son, Turner's father pled that his son shouldn't be penalized for 20 minutes of action. And maybe that statement shows just how off base we've become when sex and assault are reclassified as action. It allows us to take a heinous crime and simply write it off as, well, you know, boys will be boys. It's an expectation that lust is something that we have to give into, that we cannot control, that our hormones are always in control of who we are and what we do, and we just can't help ourselves. And that's the problem with lust. At its core, lust isn't about sex at all. It's about dehumanization. It's about seeing the other person not as an individual created in the image of God, but seeing the other person as an object, someone who's simply there for our own self-gratification, someone who's there to meet all of my needs. It's an act of selfishness, of ego, when the other person is no longer a person at all. It's similar to the way that Roy spoke about anger last week. In order for us to begin to call people names like the ones that he mentioned, It means that we have to dehumanize them, to stop seeing them as people in order to allow them us to treat them the way that we want to and say what we want to about them. And really, lust and anger are two sides of the same coin. At its core, it's about denying the humanity of somebody else. And that's why Jesus speaks so powerfully about lust in the Sermon on the Mount. You've heard that it was said, "You shall not commit adultery." But I say to you, everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it's better that you lose one of your members than your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better for you to lose one of your members than your whole body go into hell. And here Jesus speaks powerfully about the power of lust in our lives. And he does it by tying together a number of the Ten Commandments. For Jesus, it wasn't just enough to not commit adultery. Instead, he challenges them to consider their eyes. What is it you're looking at? And where does your mind wander while you gaze? For Jesus, this is more about the heart and the mind. It wasn't enough just to steer clear of adultery. They were also then to not covet another person, to not see them as an object to fulfill their desires. Now, it isn't wrong to notice that someone is beautiful and attractive. That is a normal reaction. We were made to admire beauty. This is part of the healthy sexuality that God created back in Genesis 1 from the very beginning. But lust moves us beyond that. Lust is that moment when we move from just appreciating the beauty or attractiveness of another person to thoughts about what we wish we could do to them or with them. It's when you begin to think, man, I wish I could, or I'd just like to, or our gaze moves up and down and up and down, that now it moves from what you want from them, it moves from just appreciating beauty to what you want from them for yourself. Moving from admiration to lust. And that is what Jesus is telling us here. When you've looked at someone lustfully, then you've already committed that adultery. That individual isn't a person to you anymore. You've just projected your desires upon them. They become a means to an end. And that's a dangerous slope because it treats another person as someone who could be used and then discarded. Which is probably why Jesus follows up this discussion about lust with a few quick sentences about divorce that we also read here this morning. These words from the Sermon on the Mount about divorce are not meant to be the end-all, be-all discussion of what you can and can't divorce for and the reasons in which it's permittable. But instead, Jesus speaks out against the desire to kick someone to the curb because they don't make you happy anymore. He says God sees marriage as a sacred thing. Now, there are valid reasons for divorce like abuse or neglect or adultery, and we can fill out that list. But too often it just becomes conscience uncoupling, a form of adultery in which we see the other person who is simply someone who is meant to make me happy all of the time. And when they don't anymore, then we get rid of them. As Randy Harris says in his book on the Sermon on the Mount, that form of marriage is the same sort of objectification that you do with a person who becomes the object of your lust. For Jesus, this is a big deal. It's the sin of objectification, of lust and divorce and selfishness that are playing into that. And it's so serious that we have to do whatever it takes to get this out of our lives. Pluck out your eye, cut off your hand. Now, let me just tell you, those are meant to be hyperbolic. Okay, please don't go home and grab your butcher knife. But there are people who've taken them literally. Origen, a 3rd century monk, castrated himself to deal with his lust. Ed Dobson tells a story about teaching and preaching in Florida in which a young man came to him and he was missing an eye. And he says, "The reason that I did this is I literally plucked out my eye so that I wouldn't lust anymore." But then the young man said, "The problem is, I can still lust with one eye." And that's, this isn't just a physical cutting off or plucking out, but instead it's a call to a change of perspective, a change in how you view the world and in how we look at people. This is a charge and a call to a change of heart. That we are to take sin as seriously as God takes it. And I think if we're honest, this is something that most of us struggle with. We live at a time in which lust is normal and commonplace. From TV to movies to billboards to commercials to the internet to magazines to books to conversations with friends, sex surrounds our culture and permeates our minds. And it's tough to ignore because it's difficult, it's impossible to ignore. It's all around us, it's everywhere. And so many of us struggle. Or maybe you're sitting there thinking, hey, I haven't struggled with this in years. That's not my problem, so I can tune out now. Or you tuned me out a while ago, and that's okay too. But if that isn't your problem, that's amazing. But I would challenge you to think about the way that you think about other people. Not just from a sexual point of view, but from every aspect of life. Do we see people as people? Or do we simply think of them and consider them and from what it is that we can get out of them or what they can do for us? And if still you come to that and say, this still isn't my problem, then that's wonderful. Please teach us and help us figure out how to make that not a problem in our lives as well. At its core, this is a problem of the heart. Jesus wants to change the way that we think about and look at another person. Jesus takes this sin seriously, and we should too. So what does it mean for us to take this sin so seriously that we would do whatever it takes to cut it out of our lives? Well, I want us to use the title of the TLC show as kind of our springboard this morning, Love, Lust, or Run. We need to run, to flee from temptation. We need to learn to cut lust out of our lives as much as we possibly can. And so we have to think, where is the place or what is the moment in which that sin strikes you the most often? Is it late at night? Is it when you're lonely? Is it when you're walking through the bookstore? Is it when you're sitting at the restaurant or you're out with friends? We have to learn to be aware of our triggers and learn to start avoiding them. To turn off the TV before it gets too late. If needed, then you go and you cut off your cable and get rid of your internet. You flee from temptation. But we also have to realize that it's not enough to run from something. We have to run to something. Because even if you turn off your TV and cut off your internet and you throw away the books and you vow that it will never happen again, you can still find a way. So we have to run to something to fill our lives with something that will take the place of lust. There are all sorts of groups out there that help people who are struggling with sexual addiction, from SA to SAA to Celebrate Recovery to a whole host of others. All of these programs are based on the 12 steps, and they surround someone who is struggling with addiction to sex and lust with others who have that same struggle but are in the midst of recovery, and it's all about mutual accountability and encouragement. And if you think that that's something you might need in your life, then come talk to us, and we would love to help you find a group in which that can happen. You can find someone that you trust and you respect, someone with a deep love for the Lord who can serve as your accountability partner, or a small group of people who can serve to hold you accountable. And that made all the difference in my life in college when I struggled with this and with other parts of my life as well. In fact, I still stay in touch with a number of those guys and keep each other accountable. If this is your struggle, then let's do whatever it takes to work on it together. And we also need to learn to love, to work on seeing one another not just as objects, but as people. So work on developing deeper friendships with people of your same gender. Because too often we live in isolation and loneliness, feeling cut off. If you're older, we could learn from your wisdom. We would love for you to check on us, ask us about our lives, talk about our families, share your stories about life and how you came to where you are today, because we need to learn from you as to how to live this out. And we need to continue falling in love with God, to draw closer to Him, to fill our hearts and our minds with Him. God made us as people who need to be in relationship in the image of God. And lust destroys relationships because we start just seeing another person as an object to be used. And that begins to tear at the fabric of who we are. I don't want us to walk out of here today feeling beaten down or full of shame or like there is no hope. What I want us to remember is that sexual sins are not the end-all, be-all of sin. They often come with a lot of shame and fear and feelings of helplessness and being out of control. But I want us to know that there is hope. If you think back on the stories that we mentioned throughout the Bible, Abraham and Hagar, Judah and Tamar, Samson, David and Bathsheba, Solomon and his hundreds of women, and the whole host of adulterers and prostitutes and the like that Jesus seems to hang out with, each of these stories came with shame and consequences. And each of these stories also brought about forgiveness and a way forward. God brought about mercy in the place of condemnation, hope in the place of hopelessness, forgiveness in place of shame. And all we have to do is recognize our need for God's intervention and God's presence in our lives. And so we run to God. And we fall more deeply in love with God. And if there's any way we can help you do that today, we want to offer a time of invitation. If there's any way that you need to be prayed for or lifted up or encouraged, if you need to just talk about what God is doing in your life and how God is working on you and changing you, or you don't know God at all and you want to know God and how He can work on you and change you, we're going to offer this time of just communal response. Or feel free to catch somebody after and say, I need to know more about God who gives hope and joy and mercy and life. But if there's a way we can bless you right now, we're going to offer this time of invitation. Come to the front as we stand and as we sing.